Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
We are live. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Tennis Podcast. I'm here, you're here, some of you live, some of you not live, in which case ignore all the references to people being here live. But a very warm welcome to everybody that is here live. Matt is here, and he's the same age as he was the last time we podcasted. For once, Matt, how are you doing?
Hello, I'm very well, thank you. And for those who are watching live, update is, yep, still nothing on the wall, but some rearranging of the shelves has happened, and there are some little treats in there for people who are watching live to enjoy. So, you know, slowly but surely we're getting there on my live feed.
It will have already been noted by both my parents. Matt, I'm excited about the text I'll get from them reviewing your improved backdrop.
Who do you think helped improve my backdrop? Parents have been round.
David, also known as the biggest hater on the internet, is here. David, how are you doing? Just going around hating on everything.
That's me.
What's life like?
Yeah, it's good. It's good. I mean, the only downside to having cultivated the perfect backdrop in the first place is that there's just nowhere else to go. It's kind of like being Novak Djokovic or Rafael Nadal, or, you know, at the French Open. But anyway, no, I'm fine, thank you. I've just been swanning around, ruin everybody's day locally after having done it on the internet the other day. So, yeah, that's me.
Yeah, David, you peanut. We have lots to get into in today's show, a show that is sponsored by On Location, the premium hospitality and
experience provider.
Gosh, what a terrible
On Location and... Up your game, Matt. Come on. On Location and Steve Fergal's International Tennis Tours have fantastic ticket, hospitality and travel packages available for all of the world's biggest tennis tournaments. But it is of particular interest that they provide all of that for Roland Garros. If you fancy a last minute trip this year, that is still possible. Or if you're a planner, you can book a trip to Madrid a year in advance. Priority access for the 2025 Madrid Open travel packages are available for purchase thanks to Steve Fergal's International Tennis Tours. Simply make a deposit and that'll make sure that you're at the front of the queue to grab exclusive ticket and travel packages before they're available to everybody else. Your deposit is fully refundable, so you have absolutely nothing to lose. Once the packages are unveiled, On Location's team of experts will help you craft the ultimate mature Madrid Open experience, including premium seating and wonderful accommodation. So it's basically a kind of bespoke experience. And Tennis Podcast listeners will get an additional 5% off their package purchase once the official on sale date is live. Just head to tours4tennis.com/podcast. That's tours, the number 4tennis.com/podcast for more information. Terms and conditions apply. That little interlude from me has given everybody in the chat lots of time to remark upon everybody's various backgrounds, which was slightly distracting for me because it's so enjoyable. Matt, overall, people are pleased with the improved situation, but I think there won't be no one will achieve peace until that blank wall is filled.
I put such pressure on myself to fill it with something good, haven't I?
Yeah, I hope you've got stuff to put on these famous shelves that are going up. Okay, that's for another day. For today, we are talking mostly about Madrid. And we start, of course, with the final that we were looking ahead to in our last show recorded on Friday morning. Iga Świątek, the top seed against the second seed. And two-time former champion, the defending champion, Aryna Sabalenka. And let's just say it is a match that did not disappoint. Świątek beating Sabalenka 7-5, 4-6, 7-6, 9 points to 7 in the match tiebreak. She saved 3 championship points along the way. She fell flat on her back and celebrated like she had won some sort of triple crown style event. It was absolutely everything we wanted from this tennis match and so much more. And recency bias alert here, it's one of my favourite tennis matches I have ever seen, purely on the tennis. I love drama, I love backstory, I love tension, I love aggro, and so often my favourite tennis matches feature one or all of those things, as well as great tennis, because I love all that, unashamedly. But this was just pure, excellent tennis. And the purity of it just made my heart sing. I wasn't worried about one of them flaking mentally or one of them not having it mentally or one of them flaking physically. I just was glorying in the quality of the tennis and the fact that they both played pretty much at their peak, sustained for 3 hours in a huge match and a huge occasion. And it was absolutely stunning, David. A joy.
Yeah, we might as well end the podcast there, really, because what else is there to say? I mean, I don't see how anybody can disagree with that assessment. What I would like to add, I think, is something you said shortly afterwards when we were chatting about it, and we were all just sort of drunk on the 3 hours that we'd enjoyed. And you said that it's the best non-Grand Slam match I think you've ever seen. And I said, well, I don't see how I don't remember seeing a better Grand Slam match than that. And you said, yeah, but the point being the stakes, the history, the importance. And I totally take that on board, because I think the way to put it is, if had this been a Grand Slam match, I think we're talking about it as maybe the greatest match that we've ever seen in women's tennis, alongside maybe a Nadal Federer Wimbledon final of 2008. It was up there, because I don't see what it possibly lacked. You had two players playing their very best tennis, I would say. Some fans of either may disagree. I would say it was very, very close to their best tennis at the same time. It was winners galore, and if it was errors, they were extracted by previous brilliant shots from the opponent. And if you'd have been able to crown a Grand Slam champion with a performance like that, or lost out for one when you've had 3 championship points and you kind of deserve to win as well. And I don't think Sabalenka choked in any way. She had it taken from her. It really was a joyous experience to watch. I'm sure Aryna Sabalenka fans may feel a bit differently about that. But this was the performance I've wanted to see from Iga Świątek for a while. Being challenged like that, being slightly overpowered, being beaten by a player who loves Madrid so much. You know, she's gone into her opponent's favoured conditions and she's just come out fighting and come out standing toe-to-toe and eventually taking it from her. And the level that Świątek had to reach in order to win that match was mind-boggling, and it, I was giddy on it. I felt like I was holding my breath through lots of it because the rallies were just you can't get that back, and oh, you can't get that back, and one after another, these earth-defying feats were being achieved by these two players, and they seemed high on it as well, and I loved that they both enjoyed the challenge. And yeah, I think we can count ourselves very fortunate to have seen it.
I think what I loved about it is it felt to me like it was pitting like a couple of pieces of WTA lore against one another. And it was a case of which would come out on top, because Iga Świątek wins the first set on a clay court. She has not lost a clay court match from a setup since she became a major champion. You know, that is such a marker normally, that she is going to go on and often dominate matches, but certainly win. But then she comes up against Aryna Sabalenka, who, as we spoke about the other day, once she gets her teeth into a match and once she finds her range in a match on her ground strokes and her biggest shots, she feels like one of the most unstoppable forces in the game. And that was the situation we were suddenly in the third set. Who is going to come out on top? Świątek, historically so good on clay in this position, or Sabalenka, so tough to stop when she's found her range? And I also think, like, great matches need great moments, and we got those as well. Like, I will not stop thinking about Aryna Sabalenka's second serve ace at 30-all, 4-all in the final set. Like, where did that come from? That was epic. And then also the way Iga Świątek saved one of the match points that Sabalenka had with just a swiping forehand winner. Like, those two things, and I could have picked out many other moments, but those to me will stay with me. And they sort of elevated this match from, you know, something really good to something really great, I would say. And just like you, I was impressed with, you know, Świątek's defense up against Sabalenka's attack, and how they both just held it together mentally in those tightest stages. Sometimes I've watched both those players and, you know, I think they can seem a bit on edge sometimes in matches. There was absolutely none of that. They were both so calm, so free, playing well right to the end. And oh, it was just an absolutely awesome match. I feel like one of those ones where both players come out with just so much credit going into sort of Roland Garros, which we've got on the horizon now.
Yeah, I know it's obligatory after a tight match for pundits to kind of ask themselves or pontificate on what made the difference, because that's, you know, that's punditry 101, isn't it? But I just feel like that's kind of pointless here. You know, what made the difference is Świątek won an extra point, and it could have been Sabalenka. I know that's not good trade for people that make a living out of analysing tennis, but that's what it felt like to me. Nobody crumbled. Nobody dropped their level. It just so happened that, you know, if they'd played a best of 10-point tiebreak, Sabalenka could have won it. If they played best of 13, Świątek could have won. You know, I do think it could have gone either way. It's a 50-50 is used far too much. I was thinking about it in relation to penalty shootouts the other day in football, and how it seems obligatory for pundits going into penalty shootouts to go, well, it's a 50-50 now, isn't it? Well, it's not. Like, it's not necessarily, because some teams are better than penalties at others. One team might have prepared more than others, having anticipated penalty shootouts more. Like, it's not necessarily a 50-50. Just because it went 7-6 in the third doesn't mean it was a 50-50. But in this case, it was. It really, really was. And I think we're going to have a very different conversation, aren't we, with regards to the men's final, which on paper was kind of almost as close. Didn't quite get down to the tiebreak, did it? But almost as close. However, I think the beaten finalist in that one will have quite some regrets, whereas I think this is a genuine situation for Sabalenka, where I hope she comes away from Madrid with nothing but positive feelings and positive momentum going into the rest of the clay court season. It's hard to believe there's another 1,000 event before Roland Garros, isn't there?
I put to you that she may have one regret or one concern, which is if she can't beat Świątek there, what chance has she got at Roland Garros, where it's...
That's not a regret. It is a fact.
Yeah. But this was her chance to get a win and get some psychological upper hand in that rivalry in the immediate term. Now, it feels very unfair to suggest that she's behind in that particular match. I mean, as you say, one point. But it does make me think, well... If Świątek plays anything close to that, I'm not sure that it's as close in Rome. I'm not sure it's as close in Paris because the conditions just suit Świątek more. Sabalenka doesn't have the conditions that aid her game, that altitude and so forth. At the same time, I mean, really we should have ended up, to be honest, with a final of Sabalenka at the French Open last year, and that would have been very interesting. I mean, listen, we ended up with a fantastic final and Mukova deserved to turn that around. But I hope Sabalenka can build on it and that wasn't the peak of her clay court season. I'm loving this group. I mean, we ended up with three absolutely cracking matches that I will remember from Madrid, all of them women's matches. Collins, Rybakina, Sabalenka, Świątek. And I just want to see these women get to the sharp end of the tournaments over the next month, because that could be something really, really memorable.
Yeah, I think, look, Sabalenka beat Świątek in Madrid last year and didn't go on to win the French Open, as you've said. Like, Madrid is a little bit of an outlier in terms of conditions. It doesn't always translate to what's going to happen at Roland Garros, and I completely agree. Like, everything at Roland Garros is more in Świątek's favour than it was even in Madrid. So the fact that she's managed to win Madrid, I just think, makes Świątek even more of a Roland Garros favourite. But what I would say is that I've been thinking, David, about that line that you brought up on Friday's podcast that Serena said about Sabalenka when they played at the Australian Open those few years ago. If she wants to play power, let's go. And I think that's a really interesting line, because I think sort of ever since, you know, Mary Carrillo came up with the term big babe tennis to kind of describe that era of women's tennis, late 90s, early 2000s, there is this slight sort of battle for supremacy in terms of, like, who basically just is the best power player on the tour. Like, there's always a few players who brand themselves as sort of power players. And I think Serena held that sort of, you know, she was the one for so long. She held that title for so long. I think when Serena said that, probably Osaka actually held that title. Like, if you were going to bring up your best power tennis back in sort of 2020, 2021, it was kind of Naomi Osaka who had it. But I think what Sabalenka's shown this week is that right now that sort of title belongs to her. You know, like, she beat Collins and she beat Rybakina, and those are the matches of big power tennis. So I do think that Sabalenka sort of her position in the sport was sort of cemented a little bit this week during Madrid, even though she didn't actually sort of end up beating Świątek in the final. She sort of marked herself as a clear, like, if I bring my big power tennis against the other players, I'm kind of the one. And we saw that at the Australian Open as well. Like, she didn't totally need to prove it this week. I think she's in a great place heading into Roland Garros, Sabalenka. And I also think the conditions are pretty vital in Paris. You know, if it's cold and wet and windy, Sabalenka's going to struggle a bit more to sort of penetrate the court. If it's hot and fast and lively, I'd give her a much better chance of troubling Iga Świątek if they do end up playing.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just going to mention that the best chance of replicating Madrid conditions is heat in Paris, isn't it? Day session matches in heat. Świątek, of course, won the October COVID French Open. So she has a very different position to Victoria Azarenka. on playing tennis in those kind of conditions.
I have to say, though, on, like, Iga Świątek, we've talked in the past about whether, you know, does she win enough close matches and all this kind of thing. I think one of the elevations that she's made this year is really, really putting that, maybe not completely to bed, but she is winning her fair share of really tight matches now and showing an awful lot of resilience. Like in this final, a breakdown at the start of the third. She had to serve to stay in it a couple of times and save match points. She was a mini breakdown in the tie break, and every time she just kept delivering. And I think it's just interesting how, you know, last year it felt to me a little bit like Iga Świątek was holding on to being the best player in the world. And I think this year, okay, she didn't win the Australian Open, but she hadn't won a 1,000 event before Roland Garros last year. This year she's won three. And she's really just sort of cementing herself as, okay, I've got rivals, but like I'm still ahead of everyone else. And yeah, look, we don't know what's going to happen at Roland Garros, but she does feel like a big, big favourite. And if she wins that, then suddenly she's had this incredible start to the season, you would have to say.
Athleticism does seem to be the only weapon that can fight Sabalenka when she's on, when she's not missing with that power, right? The foot speed to chase down her shots. You know, I'm thinking Goff and I'm thinking Świątek. It was so striking how quick she looked on Saturday, quick and strong. You know, the kind of explosive strength and power to get off the mark quickly and change direction quickly. But then once she's on the move, her straight line speed is incredible as well. And I think that without that, you can't really blunt a peaking Sabalenka unless you're Elena Rybakina and you've got a chance of playing her, fighting at her own game. But she was just breathtakingly quick, Iga Świątek. It was absolutely incredible from her. And now they have to go to Rome and potentially do it all again. How different do we, like, are we kind of expecting the same personnel? Are we expecting everybody to kind of continue their form in Rome and the women's side of things? And, you know, not identical quarter finalists, but similar?
It's a good question. Naturally, I would have thought that Sabalenka struggles to match that. And actually, that I kind of feel like it's quite a big fortnight for her to get used to this type of clay court tennis. Now she's shown she can move on it pretty well and get herself into position. I really hope so. I really hope it's similar. I really hope the big names are there at the latter stages. I think that does add something to the whole storytelling of tennis, and particularly at the moment that the ingredients are just tantalizing, really, with Rybakina and Sabalenka, Świątek, Danielle Collins, Coco Gauff some way off, to be quite honest with you, and be interesting to see whether she can do something about that. I think overall I would expect that. The only thing I am aware of is that I think now that they've had this tournament under their belt, a bit like how Świątek kind of pulled the cord, didn't she, when she got hurt in that match last year against Rybakina. And I'm not saying she wasn't hurt. I think she was. Of course she was. But she's not going to take chances. And I think that is, okay, we've seen more serious injuries in the men, it would appear, that they've decided not to play Rome now after her getting hurt in Madrid. But That's the question mark, is how far are they going to go if they feel anything? And I would have thought that we may see more of that. I really hope not, because I just love the incremental storytelling that allows you to just beef up the hype. Not that I need much invitation to do that ahead of the French Open.
Last thing on this match, and maybe there was stuff out there that I didn't see. I have been trying to keep off Twitter after last week's debacle. But nobody was tweeting. No players were tweeting about how great the match was. Do you remember Sinner Alcaraz in Miami? Well, insert Sinner Alcaraz match here. It feels like every top player, men and women, is tweeting about how great it is. Or, you know, Djokovic-Nadal matches in the past, or Alcaraz-Djokovic in Cincinnati. Everybody's tweeting about it. I felt like nobody tweeted about this. Maybe it's because it's women's tennis. I don't know. But maybe I missed all the tweets.
I was definitely off it, so can't help you.
yeah, I'm looking at you here, Matt. David's being a hater in the real world these days.
I definitely liked a tweet by Daria Saville about the match. She was watching it. But I think generally that probably feeds into, you know, the fact that the WTA posted like a 5-minute highlight package of this, which is, you know, if you imagine if that was a men's match, Tennis TV, you know, which, you know, sort of ATP media would have had, you know, 8 different videos lined up about this match, and it would have been everywhere. And that's a good thing. That's what we want. We want this match to be everywhere. I think, you know, there's probably also a point that Iga Świątek said at the end, like, who's going to say now that women's tennis is boring? She said in her sort of little speech after the match to the crowd. And I didn't totally know who that was aimed at. It was potentially aimed at Madrid as a tournament. And I think it's notable that there were more empty seats for the women's final than there were for the men's final, in that they don't market that tournament, the women's event, well. Like, you know, the way that they've treated that event, they've treated it as inferior all these years, and that is then going to be reflected in kind of the way that people turn out and see it. So, like, I think it was potentially aimed at them.
If or we Sabalenka. Are,
yeah, I was going to say,
could it have been aimed at Sabalenka?
I was going to say, if we're going at Catherine's wanting to find some aggro to elevate this match into even higher echelons, maybe it was there.
I didn't need it, Matt. But if you've got some for me,
maybe it was there. And look, so Sabalenka said at the start of the tournament that she doesn't watch as much women's tennis as she watches men's tennis because it's not as interesting to her, and she thinks there's more strategy in men's tennis, I believe was her quote. And I think she later sort of clarified it by saying that, you know, she sort of has to watch more women's tennis for work purposes because she's studying
opponents. There was some crisis communications, I thought, from whether there was some urging from the WTA. I mean, if there was, well done, WTA, because that needed to happen.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, she did. She rode back a little bit.
Yeah, which was a relief because they were disappointing quotes. Like, you can big up men's tennis without putting down women's tennis. And anyway, like, women should be supporting women, really. And I love it when, you know, for example, Danielle Collins is always talking about how much she loves the WTA Tour and they're part of it. Big it up. You know, it's great. I don't think they were aimed at Sabalenka, those comments. I would be pretty surprised. That's not really Świątek's style. I think most likely they were aimed a bit more at the tournament.
Yeah, and kind of unprompted as well, right? She had something to say, and she made sure she got the chance to say it. I really liked that from her. So that's it. Iga Świątek kind of completing the set of big clay court trophies. Of course, she's won Rome before. That's probably a disservice to Charleston, but not everybody plays Charleston. Charleston is it's a 500 event, but Świątek, I don't think she's ever played it. Certainly in recent times, she hasn't played it. So she's won them all now. And I kind of think, regardless of what happens in Rome, she's gonna go into Roland Garros as the nailed-on heavy favourite, but with the asterisk of, let's see which half of the draw Elena Rybakina falls in, because she beat her in Stuttgart, and that still remains, you know, results-wise and matchup-wise, the most interesting facet of whether or not Iga Świątek is going to win the French Open, I think, personally.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes. Nice
dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
This edition of the Tennis Podcast is sponsored by Tennis Channel, and Tennis Channel Plus is the place to watch the French Open. They've got every court live, and you can watch on your phone or on your smart TV in HD.
Sounds great. There's genuinely nothing I like more than watching multiple courts with matches everywhere.
And can I just sit and watch court Susan Longlin all day?
You sure can, David. Wherever the stories are, the rivalries emerge and the generations clash, you can watch it all with daily live coverage beginning on Monday, May the 20th. Be there when it happens by subscribing to Tennis Channel Plus to stream daily coverage of Roland Garros. Use promo code TENNISPOD20 for 20% off your annual subscription. Before we move on to talk about the men's finals and the semi-finals, or rather kind of one semi-final and one injury-wrecked non-event typical of the Madrid men's event 2024, I'm just going to mark your card that for Friends, if you're enjoying this live YouTube show, Friends have got another one coming up on Thursday of this week. Same time, 8 p.m, same people. Me, Matt, and the biggest hater on the internet. And we will be taking questions from the barge and answering those questions. And we can't wait. So do join us for that if you're already a friend, if you'd like to become a friend and join us live on Thursday. The link to do so is in our show notes. On now to the Madrid men's final. Andre Rublev beating Felix Auger-Aliassime 4-6, 7-5, 7-5. He'd beaten Taylor Fritz in the semi-finals, and Auger-Aliassime had benefited from the early stage retirement of an absolutely devastated Jiří Lehečka. So Rublev, despite suffering, David, from the world's most confusing illness with the most eclectic group of symptoms you have ever heard, revealed by Andre Rublev in various different interviews and press conferences after this match. If there are any doctors out there listening or watching, please let me know what illnesses have as their symptoms a swollen finger and also the need to only eat baby food, because that was Andre Rublev's situation for the entirety of last week. And still, I think, he said he was still feeling rough and he was going to have to undergo some further investigations to figure out what was going on. But basically, he seems to have won the equal biggest title of his career, David, feeling like an absolute dog's dinner. And maybe that's not an accident. Maybe that took the pressure off, because he had been in the mental doldrums for a while before Madrid.
Yeah, he's been in a bad place ever since that default and that match in Dubai where we had all that kerfuffle, and he was very upset about it, and he just couldn't get wins at all after that. I mean, he lost early in both Indian Wells and Madrid. He's just not looked himself at all. And, you know, the one thing you always feel like you get with Andre Rublev is his baseline level. You know, he gives you what he's got. It's a very high floor, maybe not as high a ceiling as some, but reliable. And that's what he's not been the last couple of months. And it's been sad to see, really. I always feel quite conflicted with him, because he just seems like such a great guy. And yet I struggle to watch him when he's just raging at himself. And I feel bad for him, but I also don't want to watch it. I certainly don't want to expose my kids to it a lot of the time. But at this tournament, he came out and he was gritty. I mean, gritty anyway. You take away the illnesses and he was gritty. He was fighting through some tricky matches and getting good wins. And then when it started to come out just how rough he was feeling all the way through the tournament, that is a mighty achievement. And then on the day itself, I mean, he went 4-1, 40 love down. I mean, we'll come on to Ozhe Aliassime's side of that in a while. But from Rublev's perspective, to be 1-4 and 40 love on the other guy's serve down and really struggling to cope with the pace of shot, not really seeming to be quite there, and the commentators we had, Miles McLagan, was saying that he understood that he was feeling unwell, and I feared the worst. I feared another retirement or at least a really one-sided match, and to have that strength of character and determination to just dig in and find a way back and make it close enough so that he could ask questions of a guy who maybe if that was somebody else, he might not have had that chance, both in terms of quality and having been there and done it, because Ozhe Aliassime isn't used to this in the way that some of these guys are and hasn't proved himself the way that Alcaraz and Sinner and Medvedev and Djokovic and Nadal all have. But you can't take anything away from Rublev in that regard. That was a fantastic win for him, and hats off. I hope he feels better soon, because I mean, he did look like he was in a right state. he was a classic Rublev, wasn't it? Sort of tragicomedy, the way he's just sort of laughing at himself and the absurdity of his various ailments, but dealing with them in a really human way. He's a lovely bloke, and I like it when he's happy, and he was really happy after that.
Yeah, I think that's something he just elicits in people, isn't it? It's a sort of paternal feeling of, I just want you to be okay.
Yeah.
You know, please let Andre Rublev be okay one way or another. And look, I want Felix Auger-Aliassime to be okay as well. But look, there has been a lot of highlighting and discussion around his route to the final, which is absolutely not his fault. It's not his fault he got two walkovers and a retirement. He did what he needed to do. He beat Casper Ruud. That is, you know, that is a big victory. You beat the guy in front of you. I get that. But it was a tremendous opportunity that was handed to him. It was a tremendous slice of luck. I don't think he'd have been reaching that final without that slice of luck, and I don't think that's a particularly controversial thing to say on the basis of Felix Auger-Aliassime's recent results. You know, he hasn't been doing anything close to reaching Masters 1000 finals, so he was handed an enormous slice of luck. And yeah, you look at that scoreline and he was competitive in that final. He did not play badly, but I do think he squandered an enormous opportunity, and he will have substantial regrets, or at least he ought to have substantial regrets. Matt, what do you think?
Yeah, I think there was a part of me that sort of felt like I didn't want Felix Auger-Aliassime to have a big moment of winning a Masters 1000 event, which it would have been. It would have been, you know, the biggest sort of individual title of his career. Obviously, he's helped Canada win the Davis Cup, which was big, but I sort of didn't really want that to come with an asterisk, and it certainly would have done. You know, it wasn't just one retirement or two, you know, three. That's an awful lot. And one of them being Jannik Sinner as well, you know, who, you know, sort of had Jannik Sinner been fit and able to play, almost certainly would have sort of stopped him. So I just didn't want that for Felix, for that to happen. And yet in the final, obviously, you know, he puts himself in a position 4-1 up. And I think Rublev, feeling how he's feeling, if he's up against one of those players that David's listed there, you know, who's sort of been there and done it a bit more, I don't know whether we quite see the same level of resilience from Andre Rublev. Like, it was really impressive resilience, and I I sort of credit him for that. But I think almost the fact that he knew he was up against Felix Auger-Aliassime, who hasn't won at that level before, has got to give you a little bit of belief, if you're Andrei Rublev, that maybe there was a chance of getting back into it. I thought that the backhand remains a weakness for him. I think 25 unforced errors off that side in the match is just such an area that Rublev can target. And also his return diminished as the match went on. But, you know, that was a good win over Casper Ruud, and it is overall a positive for him to, you know, to reach a Masters 1000 final, even in those circumstances. But I do think he will have some regrets about that final. There was some, you know, discussion that maybe he wasn't kind of feeling his best, and maybe sort of not having to play three matches isn't good preparation for going into a final like that, which, you know, I think, again, you could analyze that two ways, because you would think that maybe he wouldn't start the match well if that was the case, if his sort of competitive juices weren't quite ready from the week. But he did start this match really well. It was strange to me how he tailed off, and maybe that's a sign that he wasn't quite feeling physically right himself, because he hadn't played a lot of tennis, and yet he was needing massages on his legs and he was stretching those out. So, you know, perhaps he was more affected than we know. But I do think he let that one go, and it's probably an indication of what we've said before about him, just kind of missing those fangs, and that's a killer instinct in these big matches.
Fangless David?
I don't know. I mean, I think, look, he's had some big wins. I think of the Davis Cup particularly. I think that showed some real guts, and he sort of took ownership of that particular tie, and he did build on it, and he had the Rotterdam win, maybe that was before, but even so, since then, and I know he's had injuries, I do understand that, but he hasn't looked like the same player from that Davis Cup since that I can remember, and I think the problem is it does accumulate. It's a lot of losing, I'm afraid. As a tennis player, you, unless you're one of the very best, and even when you are one of the best, you have to lose a lot of matches. And he just looks like a young guy who was told all this stuff was going to happen to him by loads of people around him, people like us, you know, the hype train and all the rest of it. How can you not be affected when actually that doesn't happen, and you end up losing lots and lots of matches, and you get criticised because that's the nature of the sport? It's pretty unforgiving in that way. And I just think he looks uncertain. He looks uncertain in the most important moments. I mean, when he was 4-1, 40-love up, sorry, you just have to stamp down on that set and win it efficiently, and then get into the next set and try and get that early break. And he doesn't have that. There are places to go, as Matt said, weaknesses. He just doesn't have that at the moment. I don't know whether he can develop it, but he looks like it's not really there. That ability to just have no doubt whatsoever and just impose his game. And he was trying. I mean, listen, he was serving well. He was hitting the forehand well until he wasn't right at the end. And the truth is the serve was keeping him in it, and then suddenly it's two double faults in a game, and including one on match point to actually lose the match. And I felt for him. Because he, like Rublev, he just seems like a really great guy and somebody who you want to pull for and see good things for. And I keep repeatedly going back to the time I saw him thrash Jannik Sinner a couple of years ago and think, well, where's that differential? Was that a total one-off? You know, is he not able to do that? Or has Sinner just gone shooting off into the distance and improved that much? But with a weakness like the backhand, and also, you know, he was trying to hit drop shots, and some of them were working, but they all look very clunky. It almost looks like he sort of keyed in the coordinates for a drop shot at a specific point, and they don't really feel right. And I don't mean to be mean to him by saying that. I know it probably sounds that, but that's just how it looks. And I'm not sure how much more there is there. I think if you put this performance on other surfaces, I mean, look, he's done it indoors. I'd love to see what would happen if the Davis Cup Felix Auger-Aliassime came out at the US Open or at Wimbledon or something like that. I'd love to see that. I don't think
we've
seen
it. That's the thing. It was an indoor final in Madrid, though. Like, you know, that was in his favour.
The thing is, I could be wrong about this. I'm reading between lines, but my empathetic sense with Felix Auger-Aliassime is that I feel his self-doubt. I felt like he stepped onto court in that final himself very aware of the route that he'd had to get there, rather than thinking, yeah, I got some luck. I've earned it, you know, over the all sort of 6 years of my professional career or whatever. Rather than finding a way to spin that in his mind, he was deep down feeling sheepish about it. And that is entirely normal, but maybe not for a champion, you know? Like, that there is a necessary level of self-delusion with being a top tennis player, and I'm not sure he possesses it. I think he might be maybe too normal or too self-aware or too in touch with his emotions. I don't know. I don't think any of those expression turns of phrase that I've just come up with are quite right, but he just radiates self-doubt to me. I feel it in him.
He's too well-adjusted.
He's maybe it'll make for a happier human being. But he didn't look too happy, did he? Staring into space while they prepared the court and the confetti cannon for Andre Rublev yesterday. It remains just the cruelest thing in sport that the beaten finalist has to stay on court in their sad chair while a stage is erected.
And confetti falls on them.
And confetti falls on them, yeah. It's absolutely brutal. Does it mean anything that Andre Rublev's won this title? Does it mean anything in terms of the French Open or in terms of Grand Slams generally and Andre Rublev breaking his quarterfinal duck? Does it make you feel like if a draw opens up, he could be the guy to capitalise upon it?
Well, what I would say is that this draw at Roland Garros may well open up, given the sheer number of injuries we are looking at right now. Medvedev, Sinner, Alcaraz, and Nadal, obviously. And I tell you, the guy who won the tournament is Novak Djokovic. If you want to think about people that come out of that tournament thinking, oh, right, okay, I'm ready to clean up. But there's going to be, there could well be an opportunity in that draw for somebody that we would really not have foreseen had those guys all been fully fit. And listen, there's still time. They may end up being fully fit or at least fit enough. And I do think Rublev, as long as his illness clears up, I think he is likely to give you a level of performance that is high. Whether it's high enough to come through, I'd still expect people like Casper Ruud to be probably more likely. I probably would say maybe Zverev's more likely to take advantage of it when I just think about the games you're talking about. But he's going to produce a game. I do think we could be in for a surprising one, generally. But my answer would still be no, Catherine, that I don't think Rublev ends up being in the final.
I think one of our year-long predictions questions this year was, will Andre Rublev or Jessica Pegula either or both break their Grand Slam quarterfinal duck?
Could do that.
Do you remember what you put at the start of the year, and do you know if it's changed?
I think I probably said Pegula would, but I can't remember 100% now. But
you were allowed to go for both of them, I think. It wasn't
given where we are now. I mean, obviously, so much depends on the draw. If you stick Rublev in Djokovic's part of the draw, no chance, I don't think. But I think he's got more of a chance. I think he could get to a semi now with these, you know, like I think I'd be thinking along those lines. If you got a decent draw and the others aren't as fit as they like to be, or they're not there. What do you think?
Yeah, it's funny. Like, I don't think of Rublev as necessarily like a clay specialist. And I don't think he is a clay specialist. He's very good on, you know, kind of all surfaces. But it's interesting that his two biggest wins have come on clay. And maybe that's a sign that Roland Garros is perhaps his most likely slam to try and finally reach the semi-final. I think you've said it. I think the draw, it's massive for a lot of people. It's pretty massive for Rublev. If he ends up in the section of the draw that falls apart, and maybe that's doing him a disservice, because maybe he could manage a big win at Roland Garros. You know, I think that's possible. I think he could beat one of the kind of, I don't know, it feels like he would need Alcaraz or Sinner to be below their best, like in Madrid.
Or injured.
Exactly. That's kind of what I'm saying. Like, we know that this is kind of the most uncertain men's Roland Garros in years because of Alcaraz and Sinner being as they are. Djokovic hasn't played well in several months. Nadal's on a farewell tour. Like, there are opportunities there, and I do think Rublev could pounce on one of those, like he did in Madrid, beating an under-par Alcaraz. But for him to actually beat maybe a couple of those guys still feels like it might be a sort of step too far. But yeah, like, I think he's got a very good chance of finally breaking his Grand Slam quarterfinal sort of drought, or semi-final drought, his sort of quarterfinal curse. And yet at the same time, I think he needs to put himself back in that position to prove that he can do it. Like, I don't know whether winning Madrid actually counts all that much for when you find yourself back in a Grand Slam quarterfinal. Suddenly that record will be in his head again, and it's about sort of how he deals with that on the day. But look, he's set himself up well. But, you know, it wasn't that long ago that he was in a real slump and struggling to win matches at all. So, you know, we probably do need to see a bit more than just sort of one great week in Madrid, I suppose.
I mean, it's a good time to be hitting some form, though, if you're an ATP player, because, I mean, frankly, the Roland Garros draw could be falling apart before our eyes. The top of men's tennis right now is in a pretty catastrophic situation. Now, we hope that's pretty temporary. There's an awful lot of injuries that have question marks over them. You know, players saying, I hope it's just keeping me out of Rome, but I don't know. We've got Alcaraz. He felt some pain after playing Madrid. He said, some discomfort in my arm. Today I did some tests and I have a muscle edema in my pronator teres, a consequence of my recent injury. So that's the forearm injury. Now, edema doesn't sound too serious or long term, but we don't know. Sinner's situation is rather more unclear. He said, I don't want to go into details. We thought it wasn't anything serious, but then with the MRI, we saw that something was wrong. The situation is under control. I won't play for a while. From next week, we'll decide a few things. The preparation for Paris will not be optimal, but my team, we will do our best to be competitive. Arriving in Paris without matches in Rome is not easy. This tournament is important in view of Roland Garros. We'll have answers in a week. I'll play in Paris if I'm 100%. I'll stop a little longer if I don't recover 100%. I don't want to throw away years of my career in the future. I'm in no hurry. He's surgical with his precision, even in a statement about injury, Jannik Sinner, isn't he? Obviously, yeah, Rafael Nadal on a farewell tour, Novak Djokovic, a bit of an unknown quantity. Daniel Medvedev seems to be pretty injured. Yuri Lahechka obviously sustaining that injury last week. I realise there's a wider discussion to be had here about injuries and schedule and why all this is happening. But just looking at it in micro terms, this is a real worry. David?
Yeah, because listen, totally, I feel for them individually, but selfishly, from a sporting perspective, we've spent a lot of our time here on this podcast hyping these guys up as being the story to follow in the sport and trying to get excited about rivalries and particularly needing them given that Roger Federer is retired now and Andy Murray isn't the force he was anywhere near, and Stan Wawrinka's nearly done, and Rafael Nadal's on his final year. We kind of needed these players to follow in the same way that we've been getting extremely excited because the top three or four women at the moment are all kind of getting to those stages. And listen, it's happened in the men's as well. Alcaraz has won two slams, Sinner's won one, Medvedev keeps arriving, Djokovic is still there. That's all great. But if three of those four aren't in the draw, and certainly in Rome, two of them are not, and the two youngest, most exciting ones for the future, the one we've really been pinning all the hopes on, it's a tough sell to an audience to who aren't into tennis. You know, I mean, listen, I think everybody watching this, everybody listening to this is going to be into the tennis. No matter what, they'll all watch the matches and the finals. Maybe they won't be as excited about them either if they're not really big names. But it's more just when you're trying to appeal to people that are kind of, you know, not that bothered either way, but, oh, actually, if they're in it, I'll watch. It's tough. It's a tough sell, and the sooner they're fit and raring to go, the better.
Yep, we'll miss them in Rome. Fingers crossed they can get fit in time for Roland Garros. Reggie's in the chat, so I just want to touch upon the doubles results from Madrid. Starting with the women, the title there was won by Christina Buxa. She was winning for more than a bit. She partnered Sara Cerebes-Tormo and they won 6-2, 6-2. An absolute demolition job in the final over Barbora Krejcikova and Laura Siegmund. These two only decided to play together, I think, minutes before the sign-in deadline. Cerebes-Tormo was supposed to be playing with Marie Buzkova, but Buzkova got injured, so there was a vacancy, and enter Christina Buxa to fill that vacancy.
And it was rocking.
TBC on whether they'll continue to play together, because, of course, you know, Marie Buzkova is going to re-enter the scene at some point. But, of course, you have to play with somebody of your nation at the Olympics. So I feel an Olympic doubles team coming on, and potentially Christina Buxa, Olympic gold medalist. Reggie, It could happen. The men's doubles title was won by Sebastian Korda and Jordan Thompson, 6-3, 7-6, over Ariel Bayer and Adam Pavlicek in the final. Of course, the ATP were trialling these new things in the doubles. I mean, last year the doubles was won by... It was won by Rublev and Khachanov, wasn't it? Who were obviously singles players, so... Yeah, it's been won by a couple of singles players, but anyone got anything to say?
Matches were pretty unmoved. Matches were a bit shorter and sharper because of some of the changes, reducing the time between points. And you know, I was listening to some of the doubles players. I mean, you got people like Matt Ebden, who's on the council, and obviously was part of proposing all this and explaining the, you know, the reasons for it, and only having the tournament in the second week of these Masters 1000s, and others were less positive about it. Jamie Murray was kind of, you know, could see the benefits of some of it and didn't like other elements. I do like the... I mean, obviously, anything that can reduce the amount of time between points and the dead time is good. I do wonder whether, yeah, these second week ones, whether singles players are going to risk that. You know, if they are genuinely serious about going deep into the second week of a tournament, and is that when they really want to start playing the doubles? You know, I'm not sure, but I still think it's right to try stuff. And I think we've seen that in the next gen finals. Quite a few things they've tried there have ended up becoming things that we now just take as for granted. Whether it's Hawkeye Live and towels and all those sort of things. So, you know, I definitely think the sport needed that mode of the sport needs shaking up to some degree. So we'll see.
Yeah,
they've got to reduce. Sorry, Matt. they've got to reduce the amount of time teams spend chatting behind tennis balls. It's got to go.
Sure, I can get on board with that. It sort of struck
Do make a serious point, Matt.
Well, it struck
me that wasn't a serious point. I really do believe that.
Like, if they're trying to, like, you know, reinvent or reinvigorate sort of interest in doubles, like, I don't really think any of the things that they trialled this week are it. Personally, I think that, you know, 15 second shot clock on a rally less than four shots, like, I'd be interested to see that trialled in singles, you know, and the fact that they had the fan movement around, you know, free fan movement, you know, sort of during the match in the same way that they had during the Australian Open. Like, I'd be interested to, you know, let's bring that into the singles as well. Like, it felt like some things that could help the sport generally. And, you know, I'm saying keep those things in doubles as well. But, like, I don't actually think that what they did is going to make a huge difference to doubles overall. And as you said, I noticed that Fritz was meant to be playing the doubles, and then he was with Shelton, and then they were doing really, you know, Fritz was doing well in the singles. So of course, like, sort of quite naturally, he pulled the plug on the doubles and focused on the singles. Like, I'm not sure that is the solution that they think it is to getting doubles off the ground, you know, sort of focusing just on those singles players at the latter stage of tournaments when they're already in the singles. Like, I'm not sure that's it. I don't have the answer. Billie Jean King will come at me for saying it's a problem and not having a solution, but that's kind of the state we're in.
Okay, speaking of the state we're in, we can put it off no longer, folks. We've arrived at the news portion of the show, and of course, there is one big news story dominating all the chatter in the tennis world, and that is the sad demise of Tsitsidosa. Announced yesterday on Paula Badosa's Instagram. I'm going to find it really hard not to be irreverent about this. I know it's sad. I really hope they're okay. Trust me, I know breakups are hard. I hope, but they're both listening to Taylor Swift right now, and truthfully, honestly, hope they're okay. We did in our year-long predictions, we were asked to predict whether Tsitsidosa would last the year. David, do you remember what your prediction was?
I said they would. Yeah. So
David is an optimist.
So they probably feared the worst when I said that, because my record isn't that good, is it?
David's predictions curse has come down on Tsitsidosa. Matt, do you remember what you thought?
I think we actually all said that they would last the year.
I did think they'd last.
I think they lasted longer than I thought they would. And yet I still ended up kind of surprised that they had broken up.
It must be just awful breaking up with a tennis players breaking up. I mean, they're going to see one another. Like, presumably they've bumped into one another today. Like, you can unfollow one another on Instagram all you like.
Which they have.
But which they have. All of the stuff in the statement about how amicable and lovely the breakup is, unfollowed on Instagram straight away.
I did fear the worst when...
But they're going to bump into one another, like, every day, David.
When he was asked to describe her in a word, in three words, and one of them was diligent, I did fear the worst. To be honest, that was a couple of months ago, wasn't it? But anyway,
I had forgotten about that.
You mentioned Taylor Swift, David. Catherine, I was listening to LOML today, and the lyric "It was legendary, it was momentary" sort of came to mind for.
Are you saying Tsitsipas is Badosa's Matty Healy?
Who's that?
Who can say? It's sad though, because Rome was the place of the Tsitsidosa's inception, wasn't it, last year?
Mm. Well, didn't it even last a year?
No, it was almost like you know, we've got to do this before we hit the year point because there's an anniversary. Somebody didn't want to have to buy an anniversary gift, maybe. Anyway, look, I know I'm being me about it, but I hope they're okay. And especially having to bump into one another all the time. I mean, that just sounds absolutely dreadful. We've talked quite a lot about Rome, but I'll just whiz you through some interesting things from the draw. Rafael Nadal has got a qualifier in round number one. If he wins through that, he will face Hubert Hurkacz. Good draw, bad draw? Any thoughts and feelings?
Bad draw?
Okay.
Yeah, it feels like a bad draw for someone who's struggling like with their serve. Like, you've got to be holding serve against Hurkacz because he's a tough guy to break, like even on a clay court.
You don't get any rhythm.
But what I mean is Nadal was unseeded, so like he was always going to have to face someone.
Yeah, but it could have been somebody in less good form and with a rubbish serve.
You think Hubert Hurkacz? But yeah, but it could have been Djokovic.
Yeah,
you know,
true.
It's not Djokovic. It's Hubert Hurkacz. But I take your point. I take your point.
I'd have rather it drawn Djokovic. That would have been fun.
Djokovic could play. He gets a bye, of course, in round number one. He could play Roman Sefulin in round two, who is somebody I usually say, oh, that could be tricky. But I think he's been in desperately bad form recently. He's had some heavy losses, so maybe not. But he could have Jakub Mensik in round three, which would watch. Could be very interesting, that one. What have we got in the women's? Some first rounders. Martina Trevisan against Yulia Putintseva. Andreeva against Badosa. Thoughts and prayers to everybody there. Vekic against Sirenko. Oh, dear. Thoughts and prayers to Donna Vekic. She hates playing Sirenko, doesn't she? Yeah, good luck, Pam. Osaka against Clara Burrell. Sara Irani against Amanda Anisimova. You can tell who wrote this agenda, can't you? Dan Evans has got Fabio Fognini in round one. I will clear my schedule to watch that. Thomas Mahac against Matteo Arnaldi. Daniel Altmaier against Luca Nardi. And Jack Draper against Borna Coric in round one. And that's interesting because Jack Draper has just unveiled his new coach, a new partnership on the ATP Tour, and it is Wayne Ferreira. And I am excited about this, David. It's not a potential partnership that I had thought of, but as soon as I heard about it, I thought, great, good appointment.
Mm, yeah, and Ferreira's coming in apparently as in a consultancy capacity, certainly at this point. James Trotman continues to be in the picture for Jack Draper. But I do think, I mean, we know Wayne Ferreira a bit from the Champions Tour, and obviously he was a very good player in his own right, and an excellent coaching stint with Francis Tiafoe. I mean, he really got the best out of himself, Tiafoe, when he was underneath the guidance, and they were really good together, Tiafoe and Ferreira. And I just think that Draper is a sponge. He's so dedicated, so determined to make the best of himself, and he's kind of just hit a bit of a dead end, really, in terms of progress at the moment. He still plays well and wins some, but he doesn't get wins that you don't expect him to necessarily get that might shove him onto the next level. And I think that Ferreira's know-how and having been there and done it and helped a guy come through, I just reckon that could really work.
Yeah, me too. I'm excited about it. The headlines in the draw, the WTA, we've got Świątek Goff, Zheng Xinwen, and Marketa Vondroušová in the top half. And then the bottom half is Rybakina, Sabalenka, Jabeur, Sakkari, Ostapenko and Collins all in there. So that is a hefty bottom of the half of the draw in the WTA. And in the ATP, we've got Djokovic, who could play Rude in the quarterfinals, and Zverev in the semifinals. And then in the other half, it's Tsitsipas, Rublev, Medvedev, who's an injury question mark at the moment, Hubert Hurkacz, brackets Rafael Nadal, and Holger Rune in that half as well. And we had the news today that Diego Schwartzman is going to be retiring. This is going to be his final full season on tour. He's going to retire at home next year in Argentina at the Buenos Aires event, I think. And he actually won today, didn't he? Only 32 years old, which I guess is not much in today's money, but it feels like the right time, doesn't it? It's his trajectory has been waning. I mean, it's the right time when the player decides it's the right time. I'm definitely not on the train of telling players they should retire, but good luck to him.
Yeah,
hope he has a nice retirement moment in Argentina, and emotional headbands are left on on nets.
Great career.
Actually, no, I don't hope that I can't handle that again. Yeah, a fantastic career
and fun to watch.
He's somebody that I think will sleep well at night in retirement. You know,
yeah,
I don't think he'll be haunted by any ghosts.
No, he made the most, absolutely, of what he had. And I think he won, I think I read today that he won Argentine Sportsman of the Year 1 year, which in the era of Lionel Messi, who I just sort of assumed has won that every year since about 2005, that feels like quite an achievement. And yeah, there was a couple of years there where he would really push the very best players, and just always a joy to watch, and sort of fun presence on tour as well. I think everyone liked him. Everyone was rooting for him.
Do you remember when we went to a steak restaurant in Wimbledon and Diego Schwartzman and his team were in there, which we felt like was a fantastic endorsement for a steak restaurant? In fact, I think an Argentine steak restaurant. So, we sort of had a steak dinner with Diego Schwartzman, which he definitely didn't know about, but we found very exciting. And finally, a shout out to Mariano Navone, whose name we'd never mentioned before up until a few weeks ago, but now we seem to be mentioning him rather a lot. He won the Cagliari Challenger. He beat Lorenzo Musetti in the final, and that victory, not only fantastic in itself, but it means that he should be seeded at Roland Garros, even though Roland Garros will be his first ever Grand Slam main draw. He played qualies at the Australian Open, lost to Dino Prismic, remember him. But since losing in the qualies in Australia, he's reached the final of Rio, semi-finals in Morocco, the final of Bucharest, and now he's won this challenger. I mean, talk about out of nowhere. He's suddenly a guy that nobody is going to want to play at Roland Garros. That's a bad draw.
Yeah. No, you're right. I've seen quite a bit of him, actually, in various matches in those runs. And, he comes across as pretty fearless. And I guess when you have come like that out of nowhere, you sort of just think it's all new to you, it's all fresh, and he's just going to go for it. And that's how it comes across.
I need to watch some more of him play, but I'm in an Emma Navarro situation.
I was going to say, it's going to be like that day at the Australian Open where the task was to find out how good Emma Navarro is. It's going to be the task.
I mean, quite good is the answer.
Very good.
It might be the same for Navone, yeah. Well, look, we will keep an eye on him. I could see him being somebody that one of us might do something weird with in predictions, which is it's always great to have those folk lurking in the draw, isn't it? That is it.
That's how you end up being known as the Nicholas Jarry guy.
You love that bit, Matt. That is it for this week's tennis news, except to tell you about our mascot for this episode. That mascot is Kevin. Kevin is a 4-year-old rescue living with his dads, Jason and Peter, in Brooklyn. Peter now has a Taylor Swift song named after him, Lucky Peter. He's a perfect mix of Bull Terrier, Dachshund, Border Collie, Beagle and Retriever. What a mix. I'm assuming that Jason and Peter did one of those dog genealogy tests, or maybe they were just present at conception. Who can say? Let us know, Jason and Peter. When not sleeping, his favourite activity, he enjoys snacks, chasing squirrels and making friends. Billie Jean just heard me say the words squirrel and perked up. He loves watching tennis on TV most of the time, except when his dad goes crazy during tight Rafa matches. He's more of an Alcaraz fan. And here he is on a sofa, clutching a tennis ball, watching Carlos Alcaraz. And he's lovely. I'm going to pop a picture of him on our Instagram. And a correction, a very important correction, I have been told on the subject of mascots from last week. You might remember we were discussing Huey from Thursday's show. Hello, lovely Huey. David Bazaar's Huey, Dewey and Louie were. I'm not meaning to throw you under the bus here, David, because I was very much on board with this mistake. But you answered Alvin in the Chipmunks. We have been inundated with corrections from disgusted listeners telling us that they are, in fact, Donald Duck's nephews.
Sorry, everybody.
Yeah, we apologise. But they did have their own show.
Yeah, DuckTales.
Which is what I'm trying to remember. Duck!
Great TV. Couldn't remember it, though. When the pressure was on, I couldn't remember.
And, of course, the Alvin and the Chipmunks, David, are...
Oh,
we have been told this multiple times this week. Alvin, Simon and Theodore.
Well,
of course.
So why didn't you say that the other day?
I was led astray, David. You're my authority on all things, you know. Right, we have our mascots. I scored some points this week for the dearly departed Darwin. Thank you to Igor Świątek, David and Francis.
I was one point away from 150. Three times.
Matt, Haider and Soma for you. Any points?
Yes, thanks to Igor Świątek too. Oh.
Old reliable. Billie Jean is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. We have our top folks and executive producers, Jamie, Jeff, Greg and Chris. And Matt, we have shout-outs.
We start with Bastian, who is in Mönchengladbach in Germany.
Oh, like Borussia Mönchengladbach.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Hello, Bastian.
Hello, Bastian.
Bastian said he's been a listener to the pod since Charlie the Ferret times.
Wow.
Our first ever mascot.
Yeah.
Oh. I've always wondered about the name Bastian. Is it short for Sebastian? Or is it a name in and of itself?
Like That's Schweinsteiger.
Yeah.
Not a tennis player.
No, but married to Anna Ivanovic.
Married to Anna Ivanovic. So I've made that work. Thank you, Matt.
Bastion's everywhere. Let us know. Is it short for Sebastian? It's fine either way. I would just like to know. Thank you, Bastian.
We've also got Josephine Maybaum from Lausanne in Switzerland. Stanwood Ring territory.
Oh, we've had Josephine before. Hello, Josephine.
Hi, Josephine.
Come, Josephine, in my flying machine.
I think you might have done that before as well, possibly.
Now, if Ruben is listening, I don't want that edited into any kind of anything.
I do. Go for it, Ruben.
What have we got for Josephine?
Big fan of Tennis Relived and jealous that her mother and sister met us at Roland Garros last year. So we need to complete the set. Josephine, say hello if you see us.
Hannah doesn't know who Josephine in a flying machine is. I believe it's an old sort of song, nursery rhyme type thing, but I know it because Leonardo DiCaprio sings it to Kate Winslet in Titanic. Yep. Thank you, Josephine.
And finally, which is perfect for our live show because I know she's in the chat, we have Vicky Spreadbury.
Hey!
Oh, hello, Vicky. We love Vicky. We've always loved Vicky, but Vicky knitted, Well, Vicky made us baked goods at Wimbledon last year, first and foremost.
That was great.
So obviously sensational. But Vicky also knitted the most incredible and touching dress for my baby niece last summer when she was born. It says on the boat on it, and she's grown out of it now because that's what babies do. But it was the most wonderful special thing, and Vicky is a wonderful special person, and we're very glad to have her as a friend. And Vicky is very present on the barge, as are lots of you that are in the chat today, and we're going to be answering questions from the barge in Thursday's live YouTube show for friends. And one last little promo for that, we are going to be making a very exciting announcement in Thursday's show as well. You'll all hear about it, but we'll be making it in Thursday's show exclusively for friends. So if you want to jump on board that train, the link to do so is in our show notes, as always. Thank you all so much for listening, for joining us live tonight, if indeed you have joined us live, for getting involved in the chat, for getting involved in the chat on the barge. Thank you to Hannah. Thank you to Woolly, whose incredible log is going to be appearing on our Instagram soon. Thank you, David. Thank you, Matt. We'll speak to you soon.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.